Welcome back to the program. It is pretty much conventional wisdom that America's best days are behind it, that China will dominate this century, that the suburban sprawl that has blighted America's landscape will go into remission. Just this morning, Tim Egan had an article in the New York Times about what he called slumberbia and the recession's impact on once booming suburbs. My guest this morning, Joel Kotkin, I think it's fair to say, disagrees with all of that. Joel Kotkin's a distinguished presidential fellow in urban futures with Chapman University in Orange County. He's the author of 6 books, including The City, A Global History, and The New Geography, How the Digital Revolution is Reshaping the Global Landscape. It is my pleasure to have him here this morning to talk about his newest work, The Next 100 Million, America in 2050. Joel Kotkin, thanks so much for joining us.
Nice to be here.
It's good to have you here. It's fair to say that you have a more optimistic view of the future of this country.
Well, I think that there's reason to be optimistic. I think in the longer term, I'm not so sure in the very short term, but I think that fundamentally the U.S. has much better demographics. In other words, we have a younger population. We're aging, but not aging nearly as rapidly as our competitors, and that includes China. And I think, we still have a very big country. We have lots of resources. We still have people wanting to get into the U.S., including a lot of very skilled people. So, I mean, I think the raw materials for the U.S. doing well are all there. The problem is that, obviously we have, some pretty inept political leadership in both parties right now. And there's a kind of basic gloom in this country right now that I really think is, in many ways unwarranted, but also understandable.
If we look at that population growth, though, don't we see the population growth, even looking out towards 2050, happening within specific socioeconomic groups, that in fact those that are more educated, those that are more successful, are the ones not reproducing at such a rapid rate? Those with less education tend to be the ones that are reproducing.
Well, it's a very complicated picture. There's some truth to that, but there's also a tendency sometimes for the upper middle class actually now to have more children. And there does seem to be some indications that, for instance, women who we might have thought would never have kids are having kids, but they're having them much later. So it's a very mixed bag as to who's having kids. And, of course, the immigrants of all socioeconomic classes are certainly having children. They're getting married and having kids. That's pretty clear. So I think I think it's really across the board. I think there's this notion that there's a bunch of illegal aliens having 90% of the kids, and I don't think that's generally true in most of the country. I do think, and I think this is important to recognize, that we in California may see a very different picture that exists in the rest of the country.
How so?
Well, for one thing, California, it has had a very strong migration from Mexico, including a lot of people who are here undocumented, much more so than other states. We also have a very generous welfare system, which tends to attract people towards the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder, and we've had a terrible economy. So basically, the opportunities for people in the last 2-3 years have really been reduced pretty dramatically.
Let's talk about that economy for a moment, because one of the things that we have to look at if we're talking about 400 million people by 2050 is, where are the jobs going to come from for these people?
Well, I think this is going to be one of the big issues. And one of the main reasons for writing the book was to focus people on that the issue of job creation will be the big issue, and upward mobility, over the next 20 or 30 years. And I think that we've been, worried about almost everything else. If we do some infinitesimal change in land use that maybe reduces greenhouse gases by, 0.0001% on a global level, that will make us feel good, but we don't care whether it means that there aren't any jobs. I think we've sort of lost our sense of balance between the various things that are priorities, and where would there be jobs? As we know, you cannot predict what the jobs of 30 years from now will be, but certainly if we have a strong productive industries, manufacturing, agriculture, export of business services, those will, in their own wake, generate other jobs. If you look at the parts of the country where unemployment has been relatively low, they tend to be goods-producing areas, mostly in the center of the country. They seem to have held up, you know, pretty well and created lots of jobs. The interesting thing of a place like, let's say, Silicon Valley, is it really has less jobs now than it had in 2000, or it's about the same. And so what we see is many of the coastal economies and the, you know, supposedly high-end economies are actually producing very few jobs. There are very good jobs and very high wages in certain sectors, but there's not a lot of new opportunity being created in California.
But certainly those manufacturing jobs are disappearing with some rapidity.
Well, some of them, yeah, in some fields that's true, but during the middle part of the 2000s, we were seeing a stabilization and a growth on the high end of manufacturing. I mean, there's no reason to just throw manufacturing, you know, out of the picture completely. I mean, just if you want to see a vision of where America could end up, I would say look at what's happened to the United Kingdom, which is rapidly deindustrialized. Its entire economy is now completely tied to tourism and the City of London casino. And there's really, you know, there's almost no opportunity for the working class except to work for the government. And does that sound familiar?
Mm-hmm. One of the things that we're seeing, though, is that the majority of people in the world right now are living in cities.
Yes. Yes, and I think that's, but the cities are defined as, you know, wide areas. Most American, in quote, cities or metropolitan regions are predominantly suburban. They're not, you know, not people living in the dense urban core. You take an area like Atlanta, it's about 450,000 people, but the metropolitan area is about 10 times the population. You take even the Los Angeles area, L.A. has about 4 million people, and the overall region has probably closer to three times or more of that number of people. So, or take the Bay Area. The Bay Area has roughly, let's say, you know, close to 7 million people. If you really look at the wide area, the city of San Francisco is about a tenth of that population.
Right. To what extent do you see the population shifting around in terms of where it lives in 2050?
Well, I think it's going to, first of all, you know, 100 million people means a lot of people in a lot of different places. And, you know, a lot of people say, well, you know, you're in favor of sprawl and you're against cities, and that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is the preference of the population is about 20%, and that's pretty generous, want to live in an urban area, in a denser urban area. Now, many of those areas are still single-family home areas, but they want to live in a more urban environment. I mean, I live in a single-family home in the city of Los Angeles. It's, you know, certainly a more urban environment, but that's about 20 million people. Generally speaking, the rest are going to look either in small towns, rural areas, and predominantly suburbs. Now, I think those suburbs will change to some extent. They will become, in certain parts, denser. There will be growth in some of the smaller cities, and there will be some even movement into the countryside. I think that's going to, you know, continue to take place. But so, you know, it's not a question of ors, but a question of ands. And I think that's one of the big mistakes. And the problem is that we now have such an authoritarian streak in our planning community who are insisting that everyone has to live the way that they want people to live, instead of saying, how can we accommodate people wanting to live in different geographies in a sustainable way economically and environmentally? And I think very few people are willing to do that.
But are we taking into account, when we look at that movement towards perhaps the middle of the country, towards more suburbs, are we taking into account the realities of transportation and energy 30 years from now?
Well, I think, first of all, the biggest change will be telecommuting. In other words, if people will be able to work out of their houses. So that begins to make dispersion actually more practical. The other thing is the development of suburbs into what you might almost say a blend of the city and the suburb. In other words, that they will have vital town centers. People will do more things out in the suburbs. I mean, I've noticed over the years that, let's say, 30 years ago, the average suburb had no good restaurants, no no cultural activities to speak of, no first-run movie theaters. I mean, they were pretty, you know, they were pretty sterile. They didn't have much to offer. They certainly weren't ethnically diverse. They weren't diverse in terms of age. That's all changing now. I think many suburban areas, for instance, like if you want to look at where is the best Chinese food in America, it's in the San Gabriel Valley,
right,
and you know, east of Los Angeles. That is a Chinese suburbia, basically.
But are we creating not only more sprawl, but kind of within that sprawl, these kind of faux cities, places like Naperville, Illinois, and places like that?
Well, I don't know. What makes them faux? I mean, how much more faux can you be than many of the urban developments that we see where it's the same chain stores? You know, when you, in the old days, if you went into a typical American downtown, you would find unique stores that were tied to that community that were servicing very specific niches. Many of our downtowns today, I mean, I would even say Manhattan, the large part of Midtown Manhattan is made up of stores that you could find in a mall in Orange County.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so the uniqueness of many of our urban areas has actually diminished in many ways. So, I mean, the idea that there is a sort of a faux downtown. I mean, you know what? You know, how do you define what is faux? I mean, is if you walk along Sixth Avenue or Broadway in New York, and for large stretches you see one chain store after another. You know, Soho itself has become very much a collection of chain stores, as opposed to being a place which once had a lot of very interesting, thriving, independent businesses. So, you know, the question really is, do we want to have a situation where more people commute less and spend more time in the communities that they live in, whether they're in San Francisco or in the outer suburbs?
But are we not going to see and have seen in certain communities and certain cities, and particularly as it relates to certain business sectors, a kind of creative critical mass that forms within the context of some of these cities?
Well, there is, you know, certainly there is some of that. I mean, in the case, let's say, of the Bay Area, I think it's also a critical mass of money, and San Francisco area, though not really the city of San Francisco itself, happened to be very fortunate to be at the cutting edge of technological change, then the interface with the Pacific Rim. And of course, as we well know, Silicon Valley is essentially a suburban area, not an urban area. I mean, if you drive through the peninsula, it does not look like a traditional city at all.
To what extent will, and we touched on this a moment ago, transportation and the increasing cost of energy have on this?
Well, I mean, first of all, we have to go back over the last 30 or 40 years. We have been repeatedly told that the price of energy would become so high that economic growth would stop, that developing countries wouldn't get any richer. And it turned out to be exaggerated. People are very adaptable. I mean, I think there will be several things that will happen. I think they're basically pretty good. One, as people telecommute, they will be commuting less. So that's one big positive. Second thing is that we're developing increasingly fuel-efficient cars, and that will greatly reduce the amount of energy that we use. And I think if the price of energy goes up, human beings are amazingly adaptable, and they will find ways of reducing their energy use. And there's a lot of very simple things that we could do in terms of, for instance, planting more trees or having open space in the right places. There are very efficient and not expensive ways of increasing public transit if you wanted to do that. But we're not focusing on those sort of simple fixes, and we're not looking at the fact that human beings are adaptable, because I think there is a large group in our society who really want to impose a very particularistic vision of how human beings should live, instead of saying there will be a multiplicity of ways that we will deal with these issues.
As the population, though, becomes more dispersed, as we have more telecommuting, as we create these cities out in what now are kind of exurbia, to what extent will the population become more isolated?
Well, The interesting thing is these studies will show you that despite the, you know, what you would see in the Hollywood movies and the things that are said by some of the new urbanists, what's really interesting is the studies of social involvement are actually, there's more social involvement, community involvement in suburbs than in cities. And there's good reasons for that. People who live in suburbs are more likely to be owning a home. They're more likely to stay around for a while. They're more likely to have children. And therefore, they have more reason to be involved. You know, remember, many people who go and move into cities in their, you know, particularly in their early 20s, this is a phase of their lives. You know, you know, funny way, you have a San Francisco phase or a Manhattan phase of your life. It's almost like a postgraduate school that you go to. That you do this for a few years, but unless you have inherited money or you do exceptionally well, sometime in your late 20s, early 30s, you'll come to the point where you'll say, you know what, I really don't want to live like this anymore. Now, there are people who will continue to live in very dense urban environments and will be able to tolerate very limited space. There will be those people. They are a niche in the society. I think the question is, how do we deal with the fact that there are more choices? But the idea that we have to be densely packed together in order to have community, I think, is just not true. I mean, particularly with the internet, with the ability to form social networks electronically, I don't think it's so necessary to have proximity. And the most important thing is, do you have communities where people have a common interest and they're going to be there for a long time? And, you know, frankly, you will see more of that, generally speaking, in suburbs. Sometimes in brand new suburbs, a little bit less so, but generally speaking, you'll see more of that in suburbs than you will in urban environments for lots of reasons. For reasons, you know, I wrote my previous book was A History of Cities, and this has always been one of the things that the great sociologists have always noticed, that urban areas, because people have come in from someplace else or they're only, you know, passing through for a shorter period of time, tend to have higher degrees of alienation. And in our society, since so many of the new urbanites are either immigrants, recently arrived immigrants, or are people who are going for a period of their life that will be no more than 5 or 10 years at the most.
How do we fit into this equation something else that's going to be happening over the next 30 years, which is the aging of the baby boomers and the desire on the part of a lot of them to move back to urban areas?
Well, that's clearly not happened. I mean, I spoke up in your neck of the woods at a conference of builders and property owners, and they were telling me how much they had been convinced that this was going to happen. So what they did is they built very expensive housing in the inner cities. And as you know, the condo market is certainly a disaster, and in many places more of a disaster even than the suburban markets. This didn't happen. Lots of reasons why it didn't happen in large numbers at all. I mean, one big factor is that people ended up working longer than they thought. They didn't have the extra money to, let's say, buy that second place. And as a very good sociologist in the University of Arizona has pointed out, these are people who've lived in suburbs all their lives. They're not prepared for urban life. They don't want they may want to go and stay in a hotel in San Francisco for 3-4 days. Do they want to live in a small place with homeless on the street and deal with all the taxes and regulations of San Francisco? Probably not. And every study that I've looked at so far shows that this movement of boomers back into the city has been pretty minimal, and certainly as many people are moving, you know, further out. But most are staying in place, what they call retiring in place or aging in place. And that seems to be the predominant trend.
To the extent that the economy may start to improve, but jobs don't necessarily, the job growth remains stagnant, that the unemployment numbers continue to be high, what impact is that going to have on both immigration and population growth?
Well, certainly a poor economy will slow population growth. The 400 million number is not a high estimate. It's a, you know, a little bit to a low estimate. I mean, there have been projections as high as 500 million. I don't think we'll get there, and I'm not sure we want to get there. But I think that the But I think that certainly a recession and a persistent recession will slow population growth certainly in the short run. There's no question about it. And look, if you adopt the agenda that we need to have zero population growth, having a really bad economy for a long time is probably your most effective policy.
What does the country look like then as we look out 30 years out? What looks different than it does today?
Well, first of all, the people will look different. A large percentage of the people will not only be ethnic minorities, but will be of mixed race origins. I think that will be a big change. I think we'll find that there'll be many more vital sort of small urban and suburban environments than we have today. In other words, places that are able to fulfill a good amount of what people want in their cultural lives. And that will also have dispersed. And I think we'll see a resurgence of this pattern that goes back really to the early modern period in Amsterdam and other Dutch cities, where the family business has run out of the home. And that's going to be a very, very interesting sociological change in terms of how we live in the next 20 or 30 years.
What needs to happen, from your perspective, with regard to public policy to adapt to these changes that you see down the road?
Well, I think there are going to be a lot of changes that are going to be necessary. One is, we know we're going to have to figure out one way or another a healthcare system so that people are not dependent on working for a large corporation or the government for their healthcare. There has to be some sort of other option. Certainly, I think we're going to need much better telecommunications infrastructure. We're going to certainly have to fix roads, bridges, trains. For instance, I think we could spend much more money fixing the existing train lines as opposed to spending a fortune for something that, you know, how California is going to afford a high-speed rail network. I have no idea how that's going to possibly happen. But I think that what you will see is you need to invest. You've got 100 million more people. You're going to need to invest in all sorts of infrastructure and, most importantly, in the human infrastructure. In other words, we need to invest much more, not necessarily in higher education, but in skills training so that that people will be able to do many of the tasks that are necessary without having to put themselves in such horrendous debt.
And how does California look in terms of being poised to deal with this, or not poised to deal with it, as the case may be?
Well, right now, California's legislature is living on some bizarre planet. You know, they're worrying about, you know, how do they wipe out free parking. Meanwhile, the state is going bankrupt and has 12.5% unemployment. So, I mean, I think that what you need to do is to really focus very, very heavily on moving money away from compensating the public sector workers and having government do what it really needs to do, which is to invest or bring to fruition investment in the basic infrastructure of the state. The infrastructure of California, when I moved here in 1971, was about as good as there was in the world. Today, the transportation is so terrible. When I drove down from Sonoma down through San Francisco, I was thinking to myself that the road system in Mexico City seemed better.
Mm-hmm.
That is unacceptable, and that will be catastrophic in a country with 100 million more people.
Joel Kotkin, his book is The Next 100 Million, America in 2050. It is just out from Penguin. Joel, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
Thank you.